Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hello, fellow music nerds. Welcome back to Music Makers and Soul Shakers. I'm your host, Steve Dawson, coming to you from the Hen House Studio in Nashville, Tennessee. I'm a guitarist, songwriter, and producer originally from Vancouver, Canada. I love all aspects of making records, so I thought I'd make a podcast and bring in a slew of folks who've also made records in one way or another and yak about it with them. Each month, I'll be bringing you an in-depth conversation with a new guest. It may be a musician, a songwriter, a producer, or an engineer, but each of these people will have a fascinating story to tell about their lives and their involvement in the process of being a music maker and or a soul shaker. Thanks for joining me, and feel free to reach out to me through the podcast website at www.stevedawson.ca. And now, here's another episode of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. Hey there, music nerds. Welcome back to the never-ending season 3 of the podcast, and welcome to the new year and the new decade. It's January 2020 currently. It's very exciting to be still doing this show in the new year. This is the first episode of 2020. Thanks for joining me as we explore the depths of the musical universe. As always, I really enjoy hearing from all you folks far and wide, so feel free to drop me a line anytime at steve@thehenhousestudio.com. Now, on to this month's episode, Malcolm Byrne. And it's very exciting to have Malcolm on the episode. He's another one of these people that is just like custom made for this show for many reasons. Malcolm is a fellow Canadian of mine, and he's had an incredible career, very remarkable as a musician and a producer and an engineer. So that's kind of why I consider him a perfect fit for the show. He's been deeply involved in some of the most important records to me in my listening history, and also in my learning about records and how to make records and being inspired by records. He's right up there. All albums that had a lasting impact on me, and all these records that he was involved in were all coming out at a time when I was just getting into playing and recording music, and me and the people that I was working with spent a lot of time analyzing these records and getting really deeply into them. It was, you know, a time in my life when I would get into a record and it would become my favorite, and I would listen to nothing but that for, you know, like 1,000 times in a row. I don't really do that anymore, but I did it back then, and Malcolm had his mitts on so many of those records that I held so much in high regard, such as Bob Dylan's Oh Mercy album, Daniel Lanois's Acadie, and For the Beauty of Winona. I think others by Lanois too, but those were the two that I felt most connected to. Living with the Law by Chris Whitley, Yellow Moon by the Neville Brothers, Wrecking Ball by Emmylou Harris was a huge one for me and my pals, my cohorts in learning music, and also by Emmylou, the one that came right after that, I think. Was it right after that? I think so. Red Dirt Girl. Malcolm, Daniel Lanois, and Mark Howard were a force to be reckoned with as a team, and they seemed to move through the musical landscape, and they worked with all these great artists in sort of mystical locations, from mansions in New Orleans to classic studios in Nashville, and sometimes even just ordinary houses. And the three of them developed a collaborative way of working together on the playing, producing, and engineering and mixing on what I consider to be some of the greatest sounding records of that time. So I got in touch with Malcolm, and he was happy to join me on the show to talk about some of his early experiences getting into music, how he got into playing piano and getting into bands around Ontario as a kid, eventually to how dating Daniel Lanois's sister Jocelyn led to him working with Daniel Lanois and their incredible run after that. Malcolm has had a really consistent approach and philosophy to recording music that I really dig, and he's kind of stuck to it since day one, and it was really fascinating to get to talk to him about all these sessions and his way of working. This episode will be broken up into two parts because of its length, and part two will be available 1 week from today. So make sure you subscribe to the podcast to get it dumped onto your phone 1 week from today. And while we're talking about that, before we get going, just a reminder to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts from. And please leave a review, preferably a nice one, and a comment if you feel so inspired over at Apple Podcasts. That really helps out. And if you would like to support the show financially, you can do that with either a one-time donation through the website or a monthly contribution through Patreon, or you can order one of our zesty new t-shirts. And all of that can be done through my website, which is at www.thehenhousestudio.com. That's thehenhousestudio.com. Hit the podcast page, and that's where all the info is. And you can also, right there, get access to all the past episodes of the show as well. So go and check out thehenhousestudio.com, and we'll get you set up. And lastly, a word from this week's sponsors, Union Tube and Transistor. They have some new products coming down the line. First of all, they're doing a killer new guitar signal splitter called the GBX95. It allows you to split your guitar to up to 6 amps plus a DI, which is actually way harder to do than it should be. Very handy for recording multiple guitar amps. Next, they're about to release their 343 guitar amp. It features a very unique 10 and 12 inch speaker switching feature. You can run one or both speakers for tonal options. And finally, their Lab compressor pedal is a little optical compressor and is killer both in front of a guitar amp or as a piece of outboard studio gear. I use one pretty much all the time. Head on over to uniontone.com to find out more. All right then, let's do this. Here is this month's episode of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. Since there are so many aspects of what you do that are intriguing to me, both as a player and a behind-the-scenes guy mixing and engineering, which is something that I do as well, I would love to hear maybe just some of your initial thoughts about how you see yourself in that spectrum, whether you've thought of yourself more as a player over the years or as an engineer, and whether that's shifted over the course of your career as well.
Sure. Well, I mean, in the answer to that question is actually pretty straightforward for me anyway. I was actually just telling someone the other day about a tech friend of mine. He repairs, you know, he's like a studio tech guy. Chip Speak is his name, and he was working on an old ARP 2600 modular synthesizer.
Nice. Yeah.
And I was telling, you know, it's probably made in about 1972 or something like that. And I was telling him that when I was about 14 years old, in my town up in Deep River, in Ontario, there was one of these kind of traveling science fairs where they had, you know, just for the kids, you know, set up in the auditorium. And the thing that immediately drew my attention was they had an ARP Odyssey, which was a sort of a smaller model of the ARP 2600, sort of more of a roadworthy kind of thing. And I went over to the thing and I started fiddling around with the thing and just making sounds. And I just, it was like, I'd gone into a new universe, you know, I'd sort of entered a universe. And I was like, this is what I want, you know, it instantly defined what I was interested in.
Wow.
for the rest of my life, in the sense of, you know, I mean, I'd already been studying music classically, you know, I was in the Royal Conservatory of Music, you know, studying and so forth, but
as a pianist
I started very young, you know, probably about 6 or 7 years old, studying classical music, and I loved that, but you know, like many teenagers, I'd heard, you know, sort of rock records, and particularly sort of groups like Pink Floyd, where, you know, sound was as much a part of it as the songs, you know, just right. The sound of the music and various things. So it sort of instantly opened my eyes and my ears to somewhere where I wanted to go. And I just started bothering my dad. Like, Dad, I want a synthesizer. You know, and he said, well, they're very expensive. If you're going to buy something, you're going to have to, you know, work. And yeah. You know, he did a very kind thing. He said, if you can work part-time and earn, say, $1,000, I'll come up with another $1,000 and we'll buy something. So that's what we did.
Very nice. Nice dad.
And then I just, he, I love him. He's still around. And then I had like a little tape machine, and I just started making sounds and recording them. And it was a completely sort of organic process. And I never separated sort of sound creation from studio work. So whether I was playing live music, which I eventually started doing, or in the studio, for me, it was all just a very broad artistic palette. And so I still, to this day, I still essentially sort of think that way, that the recording process is sort of a very broad paint palette, where you're just creating sound and then I ended up expanding that much further in the sense of learning how to, for example, in the studio, became very interested in being able to capture, you know, live performances. You know, that being a part of the process as well, which to this day, that's something I still specialize in, you know. I mean, I can do the sort of the paint by numbers thing, where you just sort of sit down and create a piece of music just using step by step process. But to be honest with you, there's nothing more exciting than combining the experience of being a live performer with the studio, and then using it as a way of painting that thing.
Like a launching pad.
I hope that sort of makes any kind of sense.
That totally makes sense. I can totally relate to that as well, because a lot of the stuff that I do is from a, at least derived initially from a live performance. And I love that you've sort of had one overarching philosophy that sort of carried you through from childhood up until now, that you're still striving for essentially the same thing, although I'm sure the details have changed and some of the finer points have changed. But to have such a cool goal from early on that you've stuck with is really interesting to me.
Yeah, and it's you know, I mean, I know from having conversations with other people that's I've had other people in my world sort of share that experience, whether it be hearing a particular record for the first time or going into a studio for the first time or anything like that. But
yeah,
you know, I think it's something that I just sort of inherently figured I was just meant to do.
I think so. I think you're right.
I didn't know how to do anything else.
Yeah, a lot of us default into this life. That's true. Do you recall, like, you mentioned Pink Floyd as being something that you found really interesting because of the sonic characteristics? Do you recall a few other things that you would sort of pigeonhole as landmark recordings for you that really either got you into a certain kind of music or got you into recording or like really inspired you to go after something in your life?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, probably, you know, many people have a few albums that sort of got them somewhere. And I'll be awfully honest and candid and say that the Beatles' White Album in particular was a record was interesting to me, because, you know, they were obviously sort of experimenting quite a bit on that record. They were no longer just trying to make sort of pop songs, and
I'll say,
you know, they'd sort of already done that. So there's a lot of experimentation going on sonically on that record, which I've always, you know, felt had some impact on me. I sort of grew up in the era of FM radio when it was really sort of starting to happen back in the mid to late 70s. And so I used to put on this radio station. It was based out of Montreal. It's called Chom FM. And they would play like a whole album. You know, the guy would just, the man or the woman, the DJ, whoever it was, male or female, would just put on like a side.
Yeah.
And they spoke in French, of course. So I was like, you know, didn't fully understand what they're saying, but it was like, ici le premier album de la groupe Genesis. And, you know, they play the whole record. And
just drop the needle and stay out of the way.
Yeah, you sort of put on your headphones and trip out and listen to the music. And that was always something that had an impact on me. But other than that, there was two other records that stood out. One of them was the Velvet Underground album called Loaded.
It's
one of the, I think it was the last record that Lou Reed was involved in the band on.
I think so.
And there was something about that record sonically that sort of got me. And then, and partly because of the song, you know, that was a great combination of pretty great songs. I mean, you know, nobody can argue with Sweet Jane and, you know, stuff like that, as songs go, but the way the sound of the record was kind of attracted me to what I envisioned was going on in New York at that time, you know?
Right. Yeah. It's interesting. I think when, and this is something that you've done too, that I really want to get into, is like where albums conjure up a place and a time in a really distinct way, whether it's accurate or not. It's sort of like has something in your brain that, as you say, like made you feel about a certain era of New York. And I feel that about a lot of the records that you were involved in. And, you know, part of that is the locations that you worked in, but also the time that I was at in my life and the importance to me of those records. So I think it's sort of a similar thing.
I think it's been said, and I would agree with the saying that albums, I mean, we're getting a little off the track with the question there, but I'll say it while it's on my mind, is that albums to me are, you know, some people go into an album project or a recording situation like they're sort of almost like creating their epitaph or something like this.
It's yeah.
like written in time, you know, like this is my landmark, you know, this is like, whereas to me, no matter what happens, an album, a recording is going to be a snapshot, and you could have done the record 6 months earlier or 6 months later, but for whatever reason, there's things going on at that moment that are going to define where your head's at, what your interests are, what you're excited about, you know, whether it's like some other music that you've been listening to or something that's going on in the world or some new instrument that you just came across and you want to try it out, or some, these days, you know, some new program or some new loop that you just found. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, yeah, totally.
There's always going to be, you know, I mean, I remember going through a phase where I was just absolutely enthusiastic about the idea of making a record on one microphone. So mm-hmm. I did, you know, and that it was this record by this group called the Bowmans. And I just said, this is how we're going to do it. We're just going to put one microphone that's got a figure eight pattern. And they were two singers and one of them played acoustic guitar and they both sang together. And I just put them in the middle of this room in my house and made the record like that. You know, the other album that really stood out in my mind, which is completely different than everything else I've been doing, was I had also gotten into, you know, the blues. Mm-hmm. And I went out and bought what I considered were some blues records. And the one album that really stood out for me was this album by a guy called Lightning Sam Hopkins,
a
blues player from Beyond Texas. But he had, I guess, at one point he was signed to some jazz label or something, or Capitol. I can't remember who it was.
I think he was on Impulse for a little while, weirdly.
Well, they sent him up to New York, not New York, to New Jersey, as it turns out, to make an album with this guy who I just love his recordings, this guy Rudy Van Gelder.
Yeah.
You know, and Rudy Van Gelder was more noted for making records with people like John Coltrane and things like that. But there was, again, there was something about the sound of that record. Like, you felt like you were in the room with those people.
Yeah.
You know, like you were just in space. And that was Rudy Van Gelder's genius, was that kind of ability to create that sonic picture, you know, using mic placement. Everybody was clearly, seemed to be all in the same room playing together.
I'm sure they were, yeah.
Rather different than say the opposite end of the thing, where you think about a band like Pink Floyd, where you can tell everything was done sort of practically, you know, separately and
yeah.
put together in a different way. And so, you know, there's a very broad spectrum there. And it's interesting, what's kind of funny about the record is, it sounds like he was just sort of, they sort of got a rhythm section together up there, like a jazz drummer and an upright bass. But because of the fact that Lightman was very, you know, he'd play by himself, so he didn't care whether the bar had,
totally.
It could be an 11 bar blues.
Yeah.
So you
followed by a 13 bar blues.
You hear the musicians sort of trying to follow and make the changes, you know, and they're sort of getting it. They're not quite getting it. It's a really interesting album.
That's a tough thing for those slick New York guys to wrap their head around, a little Lightning Hopkins.
Yeah, I think it's particularly notable on a song. It's called Don't Embarrass Me, Baby.
Uh-huh.
The lyrics, don't embarrass me, baby. Don't embarrass me no more. Don't embarrass me, baby. Don't embarrass me no more. If you embarrass me one more time, I'm going to come down and shoot you with my 44.
Nothing subtle about that message.
Nothing subtle.
That's very enlightening that you were interested in some of the prog and super produced stuff, and then the more raw end of the spectrum as well.
Well, yeah. I mean, the other album that I heard when I was about 16 or 17 that just flipped me out was Raw Power by Iggy Pop. I was like,
oh, yeah.
You know, it was so completely not what anyone was listening to, you know, in my town at that time. They were like, what the hell is this fucking music?
Yeah.
This is the future right here.
So where did you grow up? What part of Ontario? I'm Canadian as well, so we also have that in common. But were you in Toronto or were you somewhere else?
I grew up in a town in Ontario, about literally sort of halfway between Ottawa and North Bay on Highway 17, called Deep River.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's a tiny little village. Well, it's a town, but, you know, it's sort of there. Ostensibly, it's there because of the local Atomic Energy of Canada facilities at Chalk River. Sort of originally set up as a place, as a residence for all the scientists and technicians and so forth that worked on the at the facility. And my father was actually involved in, you know, he worked on what was known as the tandem accelerator, doing like nuclear research, experimentation, and so forth. So it was
wow.
kind of an interesting environment where, you know, we were sort of the town folks all trying to pretend that we were super cultural. Outside of the town, everybody's listening to, you know, good old country music and
yeah.
sort of this interesting interaction of cultures, you know. So
did you have friends, like kids, like other kids around the area that were into music too, or were you sort of flying solo in your musical pursuits?
Well, no, I mean, probably like many small towns anywhere you want to go, really, especially, you know, Canada, there's always going to be like the cool guys, the cool people that are into music. And there was this one little clique of guys that were about a year, some of them were a year or so older than me. And they were like, they had this band, the band was called Sin. You know, they would always nice. Play in high school things yeah. where they play at the local skating rink or whatever. And to be part of that crowd was like to be accepted.
Right.
On some level. So because I played, you know, I was sort of toiling away on my own in my house playing music, and I thought, well, I want to get into a band. And so I had this keyboard that my father had helped me to buy, and I said, hey guys, like, maybe you want a keyboard player in your group. And they were like, well, you know, we need to hear you play. So they came over to my house, and at that time I hadn't yet learned how to jam.
Right.
because I was so strictly formal and
you're a classical guy.
Music.
Yeah.
And when they said, well, okay, let's jam, I was really, I just didn't know what to do. And I was so disappointed. They sort of went, well, I don't think you're going to be in our band. And I was just like, oh my God, like I can't, I'm not going to, my dreams are being shattered here. I took it so seriously. So,
So
one day I had this friend of mine, Pete Slander, and he used to just, we called him Harmonica Pete. And he would just, he always had a harmonica on him, and he would just sit down if we were hanging out, and he'd start stomping his foot and playing like blues harmonica, you know, just on his own, right? So one day I said to him, I was like, Pete, can you show me how to jam? He goes, oh man, it's easy. Come on. So he came over to my house, and he just said, look, I'm just going to do like this on the piano. And this is all you got to do is just like, through the 12 bars, right?
Yeah.
And he says, when you get to the end of it, just start it again. And he said, just do that. Keep doing that, and I'll just jam over top of you. And so I start doing that, and he starts playing his harmonica.
Sounds like a great deal for him.
Only playing like one. Well, yeah. I mean, you can only play in one or two keys. I think his harmonica was in C, so I learned how to play blues in C at first. And then he said, well, now just do, you know, do that, what you're doing, but just do it on the left hand, but on the right hand, just play, you know, these pentatonic scales, you know, this blues scale. He showed me a blues scale. And I was like, oh my God.
Oh, wow.
Again, it was another one of these like eureka moments where it suddenly a door opens and you're like, endless possibilities abound, you know?
Right, right.
And I had this idea to combine my classical training, you know, in terms of slightly more complex structures with this idea of blues. And of course, I sort of arrived at a place where a lot of English rock musicians had arrived at, you know, a number of years earlier, right? I mean, that's what rock and roll is all about, sort of. But, you know, the English always take something and do it a bit differently. So, you know, you end up with things like progressive rock or things like that, you see. So, that was ground life in Northern Ontario.
And did you have a period where you got really into, like, blues pianists, like Otis Spann and people like that? Or were you not really super traditional about your interest in blues?
Not really. I never got too specific on that level. I mean, I just, you know, I always would occasionally buy blues records. And one of the records that actually had a profound impact on me that I found in sort of one of these dollar bin kind of situations was a record called Women's Blues. And it was an album that came on some sort of more archival label. And it was on the back of the liner notes, it explained how women back in the day, like in the old days, it was actually women that played. I'm talking about like down south, you know, it was the women that played in the churches, right? Because they'd always need a piano player to play the hymns and stuff.
Sure.
And of course the women would play in the church. So they, you know, in the gospel environment, you know, it was a little more rambunctious than the sort of Church of England. Like, we are not worthy, Jesus, we feel so poor. It's like, you know, you go down to the gospel church and it's like, praise the Lord. And like, people just like having a good time and singing, you know, making a racket. And, you know, so the women would play the blues. But what happened was, and this is how people like Fats, some of these piano players were influenced by the women. Because back in the early part of the 20th century, where you had like, you know, prohibition and what they call, you know, speakeasies and so forth. Well, the idea of a, you know, you're going to invite the woman from the church to come and play the piano in your bordello, right? So the guys would start filling in that role, you see. And so they would go to the female players and learn stuff, and then they would incorporate it into their style. So a lot of what we came to understand as that kind of playing, you know, really originated with these women, you know.
Oh, interesting.
Were doing it in the first place. And some of the performances on this one record are just mind-boggling. They're just like, wow. If you can ever find the record, just
look
it up.
For it.
Women's, it's a sort of a compilation of, I think, 10 or 12 of these outstanding women that played, you know, early blues kind of style music, but never yeah. were recognized because they were women in those days. You know, they weren't supposed to do that kind of thing.
So we've sort of got a handle on your influences and your childhood, I guess, growing up playing and some of the disappointments, I guess, in trying to get into a band. And now I do know that you ended up playing in a band called Boys Brigade that I don't know much about, but I know that you made one record and I think Geddy Lee produced it, right?
Yeah, this is in fact true.
That's a little crazy.
Well, I had moved to Toronto at a certain point and sort of my late teens, early 20s, and I had this express idea of getting in a band of some kind and playing music live, you know, like I yeah. thought that would be the next big step, you see. So, and I ended up joining this punk band called Arson.
Yeah.
But it was sort of more like a glam punk than strictly punk, sort of incorporating more of the sort of the Bowie-esque aspect of things and the sort of more leaning towards like that sort of darker sort of German sort of quality and sort of incorporating that kind of thing into the music, sort of pre new romantic, I suppose you'd call it. And so I was in that group, and what happened was at that time there was a radio station in Toronto called Q107.
Sure.
And they had this like contest, you know, every year, and people would qualify, and if they got in the contest and they got chosen, you know, they got the exposure, they got mm-hmm. played on the radio, and they might potentially get a record deal. So we had thought that might be kind of a cool idea to record a song and put it into this Q107 contest. And I don't know why I did this, but we had books and studio time, and our lead singer, he was a good guy, but he was a bit sort of lazy. So we recorded we recorded the song that we needed to record, and we got it done fairly quickly. And he was like, "Well, I've got a date with this beautiful girl, so I'm going to go off and hang out with her." And which is kind of what he was mostly interested in, it seemed, at the time. Anyway, so we had this extra time, and I said to the other guys in the band, "Well, we've got another 2.5 hours. Why don't we record something?"
Yeah,
and they were like, "Well, what are we going to do?" And I said, "Well, how about we record one of these songs that I've written?" And they were like, "Okay, sure, we'll do that." So we recorded this song called Mannequin, which is this sort of fantasy song about a guy falling in love with a store dummy, you know, very 80s. And the song that we recorded under this sort of imaginary band ended up coming like third place in the thing. So suddenly we had to have a band, and we had to like get a gig, and we had to learn a bunch of songs, and so it was all kind of a last minute thing. But from there, things progressed fairly quickly. You know, we had a rather unique lineup of three drummers.
Whoa.
And two, sort of like rock meets kind of almost like this heavy sort of African beat kind of thing, and you know, again, very with the times, I should say. And it gradually came to the attention of a few different people around the area. Initially, the guy who wanted to produce our record, and I'll tell you this, it's quite funny, he came out to see us play, and he said, "Look, I've got some factor money to make a record, and I'd like to produce you." And we were like, we didn't know who this guy was, we didn't think he was going anywhere, and we decided not to work with him. And it turned out at that time it was Dan Lanois.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was back in... You know, he was just kind of getting started as a producer, you know, out of a studio down in Hamilton, you know, because he hadn't built up a name, you know, us in our arrogance thought, well, we need to work with someone with a big name, you know.
Yeah.
And so we ended up working with Geddy Lee, you know, but...
How did that happen? Did you know Geddy Lee or something?
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Well, we had our manager at the time worked for Rush, a guy named Howard Ungerleiter. He was their lighting tech. I think he still works with them, and they still work. And Howard, it sort of was a natural progression that Howard would go to Anthem Records, which was the record label management company, and sort of present us. And then I guess when Getty heard about us, he thought, well, that would be kind of a fun project to get involved with. So I think they were in between tours and whatnot, and he just offered to do it. And he's a super nice guy, and, did a real good job. And we did what we did.
Yeah.
That was that. And
that was sort of a short-lived band, I guess?
We were together for about 4 years. We toured a fair bit, a bunch of tours and stuff like that. But I don't know. There was some personality issues there. And I think to some degree, my heart wasn't really in just being in a live rock band, like playing all the time. I really wanted to be in the studio.
Right.
So when I left that group, I was sort of sitting in my room with my little tape machines making these recordings. And at that time I started dating Jocelyn Manois, Dan's sister. And Jocelyn had said at one point, she said, look, these recordings that you're doing are really cool. You should play it for my brother. So by this point, Dan, had already been making a couple of records with U2 and, was flying high on his world. And, I was a bit embarrassed, but
because you blew him off before.
Well, first thing he said to me when he saw me again after a few years was, "You fucked up." Very typical Dan sort of thing to say. Anyway, so I played him these recordings, and he looked at me and he said, "Well, where did you do these?" Mm-hmm. I said, "Well," I was a little embarrassed. I said, "Well, I'm in my bedroom in this house I'm staying in Toronto." And he goes, "That guitar sound, how did you get that guitar sound?" And I said, "Well, it's just my 1977 Strat, through a Tom Schultz Rockman." And he goes, "That's great." He said, I didn't even manage to get Edge to get a guitar sound as good as that on a whole damn record I just made.
Wow.
I was like, really? So I think Dan, as he always has been and always will be, is always looking with an ear for new talent.
Yeah.
And people who are innovative. And so when he heard what I'd been doing, I think he just thought, well, this kid might have something to offer. So he sort of put me under his wing a little bit, and one thing led to another. And I ended up sort of getting involved with stuff that he was doing, and ended up down in New Orleans working on Neville Brothers and his solo record.
Yeah. So that opens that whole huge can of worms that is for me. So I grew up sort of, I guess, the generation right after you, and what you guys were doing for me and the people that were, getting into music in the late 80s, early 90s, what you guys were doing was totally right up our alley and what we were interested in. And we were experimenting with trying to figure out how you guys were doing stuff. And so those records meant a lot to me. There's a whole bunch of them that you either played on or engineered. And I was just hoping we could talk about some of those specific sessions. In anything I've read about you, it just sort of glosses over how this whole New Orleans thing started. It sort of says he was in Toronto and then suddenly he was in New Orleans. Can you elaborate a bit on that? Did Lanois already have the house there? And maybe just tell me how you ended up actually making the move to New Orleans and how that scene at Kingsway developed.
Sure. Well, it was, again, many things like this are sort of, you know, there's some aspect of conceptualization behind them. Some of them are just, they just sort of happen.
Yeah.
And what had happened was that Dan had made a record with Robbie Robertson. But anyway, Robbie had sort of given Dan some advice, because Dan had said he was thinking of making his own record. And Robbie said, look, you know, New Orleans might be kind of an interesting story because of that sort of Cajun, Acadian transference from, you know, the eastern part of Canada down the coast to that part of the world. You know, I think Dan had been reading a book called Evangeline. It's this romantic novel about this story of lovers, you know, torn apart and then reunited through this whole, you know, ethnic cleansing, I guess you could call it, which happened, you know, after the French lost to the British back in 17, I'm supposed to know this right, okay, but, yeah, bloody years, you know, the Plains of Abraham and all that junk. But anyway, so apparently the Acadians were like not willing to sign, you know, pledge allegiance to the King of England. They're like, yeah, put that, we're not doing that. Like,
yeah,
fuck that shit.
Yeah.
The Youngly. So they were forced to leave, and you know, they made this exodus, and they ended up down in Louisiana because, you know, that was part of France. So at that time, so Dan was sort of interested in that as a subject, vague sort of piece of inspiration.
Okay.
So he had gone down to New Orleans, and he'd rented an apartment in the French Quarter, and he was just kind of writing. You know, it was like going through old tapes and trying to put together stuff. And out of the blue, he just called me up and said, look, you know, I've got this big box of cassettes, and I just need somebody to come down here and kind of do like a archival kind of work. Mm-hmm. Sit with these cassettes, and if you hear an interesting idea, you know, document, make a note of it. Maybe that could be the germ of a song. So I was like, sure, that sounds cool. So I went down to New Orleans. And we were doing that for about a week or so, just hanging out doing that and exploring ideas for his Back ID record. Mm-hmm. And at one point or other, Dan said to me, look, there's this group here that the label got in touch with me and they want me to make perhaps work with them. Let's go check them out and maybe you can tell me what you think. So we go see this group play, and, you know, and I remember Dan saying to me after the gig, he was, well, what do you think? And I said, oh, they're awesome. They're an amazing band, but I think maybe they could use some better material.
Yeah.
And it turned out to be the Neville Brothers, actually.
Okay.
And so Dan had this like apartment building, and we decided to do like two or three nights of just recording. So we knew some local people with some gear, you know, sound check music actually was. They're still around, and they brought in like a monitor system, and we set up, I forget what format we were recording to, some reel-to-reel type.
Yeah.
Not a big tape machine, like it might have been a Tascam or something.
Okay.
And did like three nights of recording with the band, and out of that came actually a couple of the basic tracks for what became the Yellow Moon record. We did the track called Will the Circle Be Unbroken?
Yeah.
Ballad Hollis Brown, and we thought, okay, well, that sounds like it could be a record. So Dan was going to do this record. And as soon as he told me he was going to make this record with the Nevilles, I was like, Dan, if you make a record with them, I absolutely have to be involved. You know, and he's like, yeah, but what have you done? One thing, like, you haven't made a record yet. I said, don't worry, I will do it. And it will be good.
Amazing.
So so between myself and Mark Howard, who was also deeply involved in a lot of these projects.
Yeah.
You know, we were like the little team. It was like me and Dan and Mark. And Mark was sort of be more in charge of setting up the gear and plugging in the wires. And then I would sort of jump behind the mixing board when we were tracking. And then I would sort of add my own musical input, you know, as a musician. You know, if there was a part, I'd say, oh, let me try this or something like that. So, you know, and I ended up sort of, you know, between the three of us, we'd end up mixing the record. And so what happened was halfway through the Neville the Yellow Moon record, which we were recording in this abandoned apartment building on St. Charles Avenue in New Orleans. Dan said, oh, you know, Bob Dylan is in town. He's playing a gig and he's interested in working with me. So I've invited him to come over and listen to what we're doing, because it turns out we'd actually recorded two, not just one, but two of his songs, about the Hollis Brown track.
Yep.
And then God on Our Side.
Right.
So Bob came over, you know, with his people, and he sat and listened, and we played him Hollis Brown. He thought, man, that sounds pretty cool. And then when we played him God on Our Side, he sat there and he goes, oh yeah, I forgot I wrote that song. That's a pretty good one.
Oh my God.
So then it was kind of seemed like Dan was going to do this record with Bob. And of course my hand went up again. I was like, if you're going to do this record, we need, you know, you and me and Mark, we need to be in a team to do that. So Mark found a sort of a small mini mansion in sort of the Garden District of New Orleans, where we set up and made the Oh Mercy record, and then we finished Dan's Akadi record. So that sort of trilogy of records.
Right.
They were all sort of somewhat connected.
Okay.
I thought it was a very strong.
Oh my God, yeah.
Thing. You know, they all sort of had something in common, but they're still separate records.
Yeah.
And to this day, I sort of look back on those three records as having something pretty interesting going on. You know, it wasn't a big bunch of people hanging around. It was just me, Mark, Dan, whoever was in the band. That was it. You know, there was no entourage.
Right.
You know, even with Bob, there's just Bob, nobody else, except his guy Victor that would show up. And Victor Mainroots was, for years, was, you know, Bob's kind of secondhand. It was like his minder, if you will.
Okay.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Wherever Bob went, Victor went. But Victor wasn't even around when we were actually recording. He would just sort of drop Bob off. Bob would come in by himself. Mm-hmm. We'd work. Bob would leave. And that was that, you know. And there was something about the focus and the intimacy and just being in New Orleans and working in that way, you know, in these various locations.
Yeah.
It sort of all led to things being done. Like I had one thing, and this is something that to this day sort of freaks out people when I'm working with them, is, you know, when I went to make those records with Dan, you know, he said, we're not going to be using headphones. We're just going to use floor monitors, like same kind of wedges that you use on a live.
I do that too. I love doing that.
We had those. And that was just that way, you know, something would happen in the performance that was far more, I don't know, it just felt like real, you know, like there's something real going on, as opposed to just people sort of pretending to do what they'd practiced a bunch of times beforehand.
Right, right.
You know, so I guess that at that time was pretty unusual. I mean, now it's less uncommon. But, you know, actually, when you look back, for example, a lot of records in the 60s, up until about 64, 65.
There were no headphones.
66. They didn't use headphones. I mean, you see pictures of the Beatles and they'll be in the studio with what they call the big white elephant.
It's right.
Big white speaker. And when they went to do backing vocals, they just set the speaker at a certain distance, put the mics out of phase with it. And they're singing, you know, to the room, hearing themselves and hearing each other. And you listen to the Beatles and you think, well, wow, their harmonies are so great and they're so tight and they're so, you know, way before, you know, auto-tune and all that junk. Well, that's because they were singing in a way that, you know, made it easier to communicate and hear each other and so forth. And
not on headphones, singing is like a whole different trip altogether. It makes people sing way differently. That's why I love doing what you're talking about. And there's so many things, like if you look on the internet about like recording with a monitor as opposed to a headphones, there's like 9 million people chiming in about how shitty it's going to sound or how many problems are going to be brought up with phasing or whatever. But it's actually like, it's pretty easy. Like it really works really well, really quickly, and makes people sing in a totally different way than they would with headphones on. And so for me, like that really works well.
Because of the way people work these days, you know, they're so used to, you know, they'll use these like super hi-fi microphones that, you know, you could be halfway down the other end of the football field and then hear someone fart, you know, and they'll be using, you know, they'll be impressing the vocal while they're singing, and then they've got auto-tune and all this junk. So, you know, if you think about that going on while you've got a speaker, but on the other hand, if you're using a Beyer 88 mic, handheld microphone, or a 57 or something like that, yeah, or a 58, you know, and you're not using all that other junk, then it's not a problem at all. And yeah, you get a little bit of what's coming through the speaker, but guess what?
That kind of adds, you know, to the vibe.
Sort of, it's precisely, you know, it just becomes part of the sound of the record.
Yeah.
You know, it just becomes part of the ambience of the record, and you end up with this sort of sense of depth. And this is something, again, that I was always interested in as an engineer and a mixer, was, you know, it seems that for many people when they're working, they're sort of thinking of a like left right spectrum, or now maybe it's 5.1 or whatever, but you know, it's a very sort of side to side kind of perspective, as opposed to like,
yeah,
the sense of depth that you get when you hear. I was really struck years ago, my first time I ever listened to Pet Sounds by the Beach Boys seriously, and I realized that the Bloody record's in mono.
I know,
but it sounds really deep, and it's because even from basic simple point of view, like the way that Brian Wilson would set up the guys in the group when they're singing, he didn't send them up around a circle. He'd have them in a line,
yeah,
in front. Like whoever needed to be the most dominant and next would be the closest, and then he'd put somebody behind him doing the second part, which would be a little more mixed. And he would literally mix, you know,
by physically moving people in the room,
by just placing the people,
yeah,
on the microphone. And that's
a commitment.
That would just go to one track.
Yeah.
And that's to me.
And, yeah.
You know, we
amazing.
Don't need to remix. We don't need to recreate that later, you know, and
that's
say,
right.
Oh, it's not quite right. It's not how it sounded when we were recording it. It's like, yeah, that's exactly how it was. You know what I mean? And it sort of all goes back to some fundamental aspects of recording that I learned from Dan, and Dan had probably learned from Brian Eno, you know, where, and it sort of comes into it from Zen philosophy, really, is that if you say to yourself, well, your weaknesses can be your strengths, you know?
Uh-huh.
In other words, you know, something that everyone might perceive as something that's a negative, if you make that your positive and then build on that, you might actually come up with something really interesting.
Right.
You know, and I don't know if you remember, but Brian Eno had at one point back in the late 70s had come up with this, what are they called?
The cards?
Yeah, the cards. So, you know, if you're stuck and you're working.
Yeah, I've got a set right in front of me right here.
Oblique strategies.
Oblique strategies.
You know, you get to a point where you know, you're like, what am I going to do here? And you pick up the card and says, take a walk.
Yeah.
Okay. Or my other favorite one was identify the most irritating aspect and amplify it.
And turn it up. Like, yeah.
Okay, so maybe, you know, you've done a recording and for whatever reason, you know, the drummer was beating the crap out of the fucking cymbals. Mm-hmm. And you're like, you go in a mix and you're just like, oh my God, what am I going to do? Am I going to use gates? Am I going to EQ this out of it? And instead of sort of fighting it, you think, what if I just took the cymbals as my cue and thought, well, what can I do to enhance that and make that more interesting rather
yeah.
than trying to make the micro? And this is where I get a little irate, you know, this whole sort of idea of micromanagement of sound, you know, and because of the way technology has evolved, it's like people, they can just infinitely micromanage every aspect of a recording, you know,
yeah.
Whereas, you know, if you're sort of stuck with something because the person was singing on a floor monitor, so you've got a certain thing going on, well, you just kind of have to live with it, man. And
yeah,
that's
man.
That. So with that in mind, how about using that as your guide to go somewhere with it, as opposed to struggling away and thinking, oh, we have to do this all over again? Because maybe what the one thing you did get out of that person singing on the monitor was a great performance,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, like a really emotional, connected musical performance.
Right.
You know, and after all, it's music, right? It's all music, and everything, in my opinion, like when someone says that sounds very musical to me, that means something to me.
Right.
Right. If someone starts talking about, well, you know, the frequency response and blah, 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 blah. And I'm like,
you're sleeping.
No, I don't care. I'm not interested in bits and how many track counts you're going to have and how many, what is 32 bit or 64. I just, whatever. It's like,
whatever works.
You know?
Yeah.
Whatever helps me get a great performance and capture something interesting is all I'm ever interested in.
I like it.
And that's something I don't think I can really change. I had that experience last year with a guy. I made a record, this guy named Stephen Clare. It's a really good album, by the way. And at first I thought, you know, in headphones, he always sounded a bit restricted. You know, like I'd heard him singing live in rehearsal space, and I was like, yeah, he's really getting into it, you know? And then when we were recording, and then lights on, red lights on, you know, he's in the headphones, and he's like, I could feel he wasn't singing like 100%, you know?
Yeah.
I said to him, Steven, why don't we just try? I'll just turn on the studio speakers and just try singing to the monitor. And he was kind of wigged out, you know, and he was like, didn't want to do it. Eventually I managed to get him to do it, and he did it, and he said, okay, well now we've done that, let me sing it again, you know, in the headphones. So he sang a few more takes, then we're going back through the takes and we're listening, and you know, I put the first take where he was in the headphones, and that's not so good, in the second, and then I put the one up that he'd sang to the speakers, and he goes, oh, that one sounds pretty good. And then I played the next one, he goes, oh, that one's not, and he goes, and I said, well, guess what, the one that you thought had the most to it that you liked was the one that you sang to the speakers. I was like, oh, okay. So from there on in, you know, that's what we did. Like Emmy Lou Harris is a bit like that. She she really loves headphones. She likes to feel like she's inside the thing, and that's fair enough. And we'll work that way if we have to, you know, it's cool. But, and then the only thing, for example, on Oh Mercy that would ever get overdubbed would be because Bob's constantly reworking his lyrics. You know, he'd come back in the next day and say, oh, I've got a better phrase for this line, or even just a better word. So we'd have to like punch in just that one.
Oh, really?
Because we were recording and he'd be playing his guitar and singing, basically you'd always record the person singing and playing. Like I'd always insist, like, make sure when you're singing, you're playing an instrument.
Yeah.
Because then if we have to go punch it in later, you know, we'll have that matchup. So any given vocal take would always have an accompanying acoustic guitar track to it.
Right, yeah.
So when you did a punch in, you had to punch in not just the acoustic, the vocal, but the accompanying, because it would have a bit of leakage in it. And,
yeah.
You know what I mean?
Was Bob pretty amenable to your guys' sonic vision and experimentation, or was he picky at all, or directive, or was he just like going with the flow and digging it?
For the most part, he was into it. I mean, it was kind of funny because at one point, I distinctly remember Dan saying to Bob, so Bob, what do you think about our way of recording? You know, this sort of like everybody in the room together. Bob said, yeah, big deal. Everybody was doing that back in the 60s, you know. I mean, we used to do that back in, you know. So, it's not a new concept. I mean,
right, yeah, he'd done it before.
A lot of people used to record like that, but then as technology progressed and you get more isolated and you have more tracks, you know, people start sticking each other in booths and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know what? Some amazing records have been done that way.
Yeah, sure.
I'm not knocking them. No, there's no what, right, wrong way to make a great piece of work. I mean, whatever works for the individual, and you know, that still applies even for today. Like I've heard incredible recordings that were done on someone's like iPhone, you know, just using GarageBand, you know.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter to me, you know, what the technology is. You know, it's more about have you got a good idea, you know. But other than that, the only time I remember at one point Bob got a little stressed out about the fact that I don't mind talking about this because he actually has a whole chapter in his book Chronicles about that record.
Right.
And he actually mentions some of this stuff, so it's not like I'm saying something off the record that I'm not supposed to say, but he got a little worried because we weren't, not all the tracks were recorded with a full band. And for him, that was kind of bizarre. Like, some of the tracks are just like an 808
right.
beatbox, just the bass drum sort of keeping this pulse, and then just Dan and Bob on, you know, Dan was mostly playing like an old National guitar on that record through a delay, and Bob was just playing acoustic guitar, and sometimes I'd be playing just bass, you know, while we were tracking, and then we'd just add a few more things to it, and that would be that. But for some reason, Bob thought that that didn't really sound like a record. He literally said at one point, "Yeah, it sounds like a demo," you know, like
so right.
That kind of upset Dan a little bit when he heard that, because, you know, Dan was like, you know, a bit offended by being told that this fine piece of work was sounded like a demo.
All right, that was part one of my conversation with Malcolm Byrne. Hope you enjoyed it. Part two will be coming out next week. That's 1 week from today. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast to get it, and we'll see you then. Thanks for listening. Thank you for listening, everybody. The Music Makers and Soul Shakers podcast was recorded in Nashville, Tennessee at the Hen House Studio. You can visit us online at www.stevedawson.ca. As always, I would like to thank Jeremy Holmes in Vancouver, BC for his help with research, and we'll see you next month for another gripping episode of Music Makers and Soul Shakers.